From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, this Labor Day weekend, it's time to consider labor, the childbirth kind, and ask why is it so dangerous for women to give birth in Texas. And fast food workers say they want better pay and they want to form a union, but will that make your Happy Meal unhappy?
You know, you drive up to the window, you get your food, but what's going on in the back of the house is a lot of hard work.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Labor Day Monday, protests will be held across the nation and here in Texas over what's being called an American maternity crisis. The 2013 Rally to Improve Birth is looking to spotlight the fact that the United States ranks 45 in the world for fatal outcomes in childbirth, either for the child or the mother. In 2011, Texas women died in childbirth at a rate of 24.6 per 100,000. That's according to the UT Health Science Center in San Antonio. Texas should be seeing only about 5 deaths per 100,000, according to the experts. Tiffany Hartnett is a birth doula, an advocate for safe and healthy births, and she is organizing the San Antonio Rally to Improve Birth.
We have a big problem in Texas, and the maternity care that moms are receiving is not benefiting them. So the research shows that 9 out of 10 women in the U.S. receive care that increases rather than decreases the risk of harm to them and their babies.
I mean, there are statistics that show that morbidity during birth, the fatalities in Texas or in the United States is quite high. It's much higher than other developed nations, right?
Absolutely. We're ranked by the World Health Organization, I think, ranks us at about 50th for, and I don't know if that's maternal or infant, but it's very close for both of them. So there are many much less developed countries that can, I mean, that moms and babies are staying alive more. So we have the highest maternity care costs in the world, but we're ranked, you know, between 45th and 50th for maternal safety. And that's actually from the United Nations. And so that means we're tied, our maternal death rate is tied with Iran and Hungary.
So what's wrong? What is the problem?
Okay, so the problem is women are not receiving care that's based on evidence. They are receiving the care that their physicians are providing to them, which is oftentimes, unfortunately, driven by profit, convenience, and liability.
Oh, so you're blaming doctors. You're blaming the system. You're not looking at things like, well, we have low birth weight, we have lack of health care. It's the doctors.
Right. I mean, I know that is talked about, but I'll say this. Some will point to the older, more obese, less healthy moms as the reason, but research shows that the most variability in rates is really among low-risk moms. So the Joint Commission, which is the National Accrediting Body for Hospitals, recently pointed to physician factors, and this is actually what I'm telling you is straight out of our press release, but physician factors as the driving force in these differences. And the more you dig into the research, the more you will see that the overuse of unnecessary medical interventions is absolutely what's leading to the complications and death and harm to these moms and babies. Not that the health of the mother isn't a contributing factor in some cases, but just because a mother is obese or diabetic or older does not mean that she's going to have a complicated birth. I mean, she can still have a very healthy birth and outcome. But when they are way overusing multiple interventions, like the use of Pitocin, which is the drug to induce a labor or to augment a labor that's not moving as quickly as the doctor would wish, complications arise. You know, when you have Pitocin in your birth, you're doubles your chances of having a surgery. And when you have major abdominal surgery, lots of other risks go up as well for infection and, you know, sadly, death.
I mean, when I've spoken to researchers who are looking at this, they tell me that the problems are women are having children later in life,
right,
and also the lack of prenatal care.
Right. So I read in your article that you wrote that the task force has decided on the answers to the problem. What I thought was interesting is it sort of sounded like they were gathering data now to back up their hypothesis.
Okay, so but to bottom line this right now is that in Texas and in the United States, we have an issue of expectant mothers go into the hospital to have children, and they are subjected to unnecessary risk and possible mortality.
Absolutely, yeah. Harm in some fashion and death.
In the last legislative session, they passed a law which requires when there is a fatality during childbirth for the mother that the local, I guess the medical examiner's office, or someone has to write a report. Someone has to investigate what went wrong. They're hoping to do more data gathering and
right.
to figure out what is the problem.
I have heard, I can't give you the specifics right now, but I've heard that the United States keeps much less data on and does less research on the cause of maternal death in childbirth. Like, I know that England has a totally different process for evaluating what's happening with moms there.
Yeah, but they got socialized medicine.
It's true. It's true. But I think it's important. I mean, we were talking about, you know, a provision passing for them to start investigating and looking into it. I think we have to wait and see what is uncovered, because I think right now what we're looking at.
But this thing, this investigation into each death and childbirth mm-hmm. used to mm-hmm. be the norm in the United States in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Right.
And then when we hit our modern age of medicine,
medical,
it was deemed
right.
deemed no longer necessary. On Labor Day, what's happening?
Yes, right. So we've got people rallying in 170 cities in the U.S. Every state is represented, plus Japan, Australia, and Canada. And there'll be an estimated 12,000 people involved in, you know, peacefully rallying in their cities or towns, holding posters, raising awareness, and communicating with the community about the maternal health crisis in this country.
I mean, why do a rally? I mean, do y'all think that this is a lack of awareness? You think there is a level of complacency
yeah.
about this issue?
Absolutely. I think there's a lack of awareness, and I think that they don't know the problem exists, and they don't understand that there's something that can be done about it. You know, it's very easy to write it off as, like, moms aren't as healthy, moms are choosing, you know, C-sections, I mean, different excuses that people give. But the reality is that is not the whole truth. That is not, those are not the factors that are contributing to what we're really dealing with. And we need to look at the big picture and see what's causing these problems and these deaths with moms and babies and start digging. And really it's about helping moms advocate for themselves, helping moms know what questions to ask and how to get a healthcare provider that's going to support them in the choices that they're making for themselves.
So that every expectant mother, at least here in the United States, I mean, should have the expectation of having a safe birth.
It shouldn't be so hard. And we think that because we live in the United States of America and we pay more for our health care than anywhere else in the world, we have higher medical technology than anywhere else in the world, we should be ranked first in safety in birth, and we're not.
Now, trying to make abortion safer in Texas was a big issue mm-hmm. in the last legislative session. And, you
right.
know, we had special sessions and we had filibusters and rallies and all this kind of cacophony about this. And, of course, comparing abortion mortality to birth mortality, birth is much more dangerous than having an abortion.
Absolutely. And we... Improving Birth does not take a stance on abortion. We've got awesome supporters on both sides of the issue, so we agree to meet on the common ground around birth. But I appreciate what you say. I mean, the right that a woman has for what happens to her body is important, and I think that safety in pregnancy and childbirth is paramount and far exceeds what's happening in other areas.
Right, and so without commenting about abortion and the right to mm-hmm. choose and the right to life and all the other kind of things, if we could
right.
just tap into that same energy for the people who wanted to make abortion safer in Texas, to make birth safer in Texas, we could get a lot done.
Absolutely. Well, I think it comes back to moms educating themselves and knowing what the evidence supports. I mean, you really need to be able to walk into your doctor's office and say, you know, I've read this great Cochrane review, and it says that I need to do X, Y, and Z to have a good birth experience, and your doctor needs to sit down and talk to you about it.
Tiffany Hartnett is a birth doula. She's an advocate for safe and healthy births, and she's organizing the San Antonio Rally to Improve Birth. There's more information about the protest at rallytoimprovebirths.com and on our website, tpr.org. The minimum wage in America is $7.25 an hour. On Thursday, a handful of fast food workers in Texas and across the nation staged a dramatic one-day strike to demand higher wages. They would like to be paid $15 per hour. We're going to hear reaction from the Texas Restaurant Association, but first, let's talk to Greg Lee. He's an Austin fast food worker who joined the strike.
We went on strike today, and it was good. We had a good turnout, you know, and I am so glad the way things turned out today. People are starting to really take us serious now.
So you went on strike. You work at a Long John Silver in Austin.
Yes,
what
sir.
Did that mean? You were on the schedule today and you didn't show up? How did that work
right.
out?
Right. I was on the schedule to work today. I'm the head cook in the mornings, and me along with two managers and another cook, we went on strike this morning. And it really was effective, and that was the purpose, to let our corporate people know that, you know, we know what's going on. We know that they're making billions, and they're paying us pennies, and we just tired of it.
Are you going to lose your job because you didn't do your shift?
No, we're not worried that, you know, we're ready for anything. We're ready for the struggle, whatever we have to do to be unionized. You know, we are very ready.
So you're going to go back to work on your next shift?
Yes.
Okay, and so you're organizing a union. How does that work?
Well, I'm not sure of all the processes. You know, it's in the works. I'm learning everything each day as I learning with the AFL-CIO, and they're really grooming us on how things are supposed to be done.
So, how much do you make an hour over at Long John Silver?
I make $7.25 an hour, and that's not enough to do anything. You know, because I try to provide for my family, and I could barely pay a bill.
$7.25 an hour. Have you tried to go elsewhere where you could get a better wage?
Yes, I have. I've been everywhere. You know, when I was first evacuated from New Orleans to here, you know, me along with 10 other people were evacuated to the convention center, and I didn't miss from that day to the present. I've been looking for work, and I've been doing, like, odd jobs, and the places I had applied for, people been there on long terms, you know. You got people who got degrees that's doing the work that I do, and they've been there forever, and I'm just having a hard time really landing that job that I went to culinary school to do, and when they do hear my qualifications on all the experience that I have, you know, 90%, other restaurants, or the fine dining restaurants, they usually say I'm overqualified. This market is very competitive.
You used to work on a line in Bourbon Street in New Orleans.
Yes, at two different restaurants, at GW Finn's and Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House on Bourbon Street.
So what happens now? I mean, is this going to continue? Because one day strike, you think that's going to change things?
Well, we have the undivided. We have the attention now. And you know, we made our move, and, you know, we're going to see what they're going to do now. And we also understand before we decided to make our move that it will be a process. Everything takes a process, you know, so we're just going to see what's going to happen.
You know, I eat fast food almost every day.
Yes.
And I depend upon it. I got to run out the door, got to grab something real quick, get back to my desk. Do you think that people like me, that we need to just start bringing our lunch if we know that the fast food workers aren't being taken care of right?
No, it's more of just join our fight. You know, we're not saying don't go to the restaurants. You know, just join our fight and, you know, believe what we believe in, because we are, like I said, these are multi-billion-dollar companies that's paying people that feed you guys pennies. And that's not fair. We can't do anything with it, you know. And we everyday folks like you are. And don't get me wrong, you know, we make the jobs look easy by, you know, you drive up to the window, you get your food. But what's going on in the back of the house is a lot of good hard work, you know, that people take pride in doing. And they say that it's a lot of entry-level people that's back there doing things, but there are people that there that has families, that's raising families. Me, myself, I'm raising children, and I'm almost a grandparent. And And I am a provider. And I try to do the best I can the right way. And why not make a good salary doing it?
So when I drive up and I get my lunch, and generally the cost is a little bit more than the $7.25 that you're making in an hour. So that one vehicle that comes through in that hour, and generally, I mean, it's always a long line, there's got to be a profit being made there, you know?
Sure. Yes. Yes, it is. Well, that's something we don't see because we are hourly wage, you know? And as far as growing, being managers, it's only 2% that really sees that. You know, the people like me, you know, I just started there and, you know, and the chances of me seeing that management position, who knows, you know, how long I have to work for that to happen, you know?
Right. So as I understand it, that the wages have been flat for fast food workers for the last 12 years.
Yes, sir.
And they have not increased at all. But we've seen dramatic increases in the profit margin of the corporations.
Yes.
And we've seen huge increases for the pay of the top executives.
Right.
So, and what do you think will happen to the price of for me to go through to go eat at a fast food restaurant if they did give you the $19 an hour that you guys want?
I don't know. You know, I really look at it like this. They already done made billions, and it shouldn't be an effective price on the product. You know, because that's the excuse that they're saying right now. If they give us the raise, that the food price is going to go up. But I feel that for years you done made billions and billions of dollars. What reason is the food going to go up?
Do you think that there's plenty of money to go around? They're just taking it all in one direction.
Yes, sir.
So you go on strike, corporations are saying, well, we're not going to worry about that today. You're going to have to do more than just go on strike for one day. So y'all going to do more?
Yes, sir. You know, it's like I said earlier, it's a process what we did today, and we're going to keep on until we get the answers we need to hear. You know, if it's not 15, it's something better than what we're getting now.
Greg Lee works at a Long John Silver's fast food eatery in Austin. He joined the one-day strike on Thursday. He is hoping to join a union to achieve a better wage. Ricky Jackson is the CEO of the Texas Restaurant Association. He says paying the workers $15 an hour isn't economically feasible for the fast food industry.
Well, let me first say I understand and appreciate their exercising, you know, their right to express their opinions. Our system of labor management accommodation allows for that. I do also, however, believe that there's another opinion that should be expressed, and that's the side of the businesses that have to, meet the demands of satisfying consumers and offering a value proposition to the customers that we try to serve every day. And I think that's where, you know, that difference of opinion really begins to escalate because, you know, if all you have to do is walk through a grocery store and see that it's very easy to substitute, you know, fully prepared products for the restaurant meal that people enjoy, and that substitution can occur at a much lower cost. So, you know, it's very important that, you know, we maintain a value in the eyes of our customers. And to do that, you know, we have to look at all of the costs, including labor costs, that goes into the production of that meal.
So you're talking about how the profit margins are very slim for many of these fast food restaurants and that the competition is tough against you know, people starting to cook their own meals or there are a lot of options out there for people. The market is setting the wages at minimum wage.
Well, actually, it's a little bit of a misnomer to say that the wages are at minimum wage. You know, I think minimum wage is really a starting wage in our industry. You know, it is where workers, you know, may come in when they don't have the skills that they need to command a higher wage. and we are the industry that really, you know, provides those skill sets to those unskilled workers so that they can go on and earn a living. You know, if you look at, you know, the restaurant industry, I think 50% of all adults have worked, you know, in the restaurant industry at some point in their life. When you, one in four in the workforce got their first job in the restaurant industry. So we really train America's workers and make them better workers, more productive, and really create for them the opportunity to earn higher wages.
How practical is it to have a $15 an hour minimum wage for fast food workers? That's what they're asking for.
Well, I think if I were to have the $15 workers product in one line for the hamburger and the $9 workers product in another line and let the public vote by their, you know, which line they began to purchase the hamburgers in, I think the $9 wage worker line would be much longer because, you know, they're going to vote to get the best value for their dollar. So I think it's not a practical idea that we're going to be able to bring initial wages up to $15 an hour. And when you look at the fact that 70% of those workers earning that starting wage are under the age of 25, that over half of those are teenagers, and the vast majority of those are working part-time and are transitional, it just doesn't, you know, fit our business model, and I think it would, you know, create costs that consumers would not be willing to support.
So working at a fast food restaurant is not intended to be a career.
Working in a quick service restaurant can't be a career because it is for many people, you know. But you know, that starting wage in the quick service restaurant is. You know, not where someone's going to end in that career. You know, 9 out of 10 salaried employees in our industry started in an entry-level position. But when they get their skill sets and when they become more productive, you know, they move up and their pay moves up and they become, you know, more important to the growth of the business. You know, we're all about providing quality food and great service, and we've got to have a good team around us to do that.
Ricky Jackson is the CEO of the Texas Restaurant Association. On Thursday, select fast food workers joined a one-day strike across the nation and parts of Texas seeking higher wages. 21 years after being convicted on child sex abuse charges, two daycare operators from Oak Hill are asking a Texas judge for a new trial. The couple was sentenced to 48 years each for multiple abuse charges involving satanic rituals, human and animal sacrifice in and around the daycare center they ran from 1997 to 1991. But now the evidence used to convict them has been called into question, and some of the witnesses have recanted their testimony. From KUT Austin, Karen Bernstein reports.
In 1989, Fran Keller and her husband Dan wanted to find work with a purpose, something that could bring them closer to their community. They opened up a daycare center in their rented house in Oak Hill with a desire to take in preschool-age children and toddlers. But Fran Keller says she never expected to find herself here, now serving her 23rd year in prison at the Crane Unit in Gatesville, Texas.
We'd never been in trouble, never. It was crazy. You know, I've watched children all my life. Even when my kids were little, never, ever been accused of doing anything. Never.
In 1992, she was convicted of aggravated sexual assault of Christy Chaviers, a 3-year-old child. The trial took close to 2 years to prepare from the accounts of 3 children from the daycare center. Texas had seen its share of sex abuse cases involving young children in the 1980s, but the Kellers were accused of crimes that went beyond what is commonly considered sexual abuse.
Specialists say that we were supposed to have buried children and taken the kids to the cemetery and flown them to Vegas and California and Japan and all of that. And we had an airstrip in back of the house and dinosaurs and sharks in the pool. It was just so far-fetched, I had no idea anybody could believe such stories.
America in the 1980s witnessed a wave of hysteria surrounding satanic ritual abuse. Not since the Salem witch trials had people reported such lurid tales, group mind control, human and animal sacrifice. Talk show hosts like Geraldo Rivera amplified the temperature of the time.
We have to take a break right here. Next, more on the connection between Satanism and violence, including more charges of the sexual abuse of children. If you have let your kids watch up until now, we urge you, ladies and gentlemen, we are not kidding. Get them away from the TV during our next report. We'll be right back.
Keith Hampton is the Kellers' lawyer for their appeal. He was a young law student in the 1980s and the early 90s, married with children of his own.
I think most social scientists would agree that part of the basis for it is that you had a generation that for the first time were leaving their children in daycares. The daycare industry exploded, and that's where parents were leaving their kids. And so the neurosis was, oh my God, you know, is there anything bad happening to my child at this daycare?
By 1991, there were more than 10 daycare centers in the United States accused of sexual abuse. Most of the daycare owners went to prison. As in the Kellers case, the charges often involved satanic ritual abuse. Most were based on accounts from preschool-age children.
Once the notion that satanic activities were occurring, guess what? They were finding them all over the United States. Hundreds and hundreds of cases of abuse, none of it physically verified, just children giving stories, then more stories and more elaborate stories. And then when law enforcement got captured into it, it lent it greater credibility because our law enforcement officers were taking it seriously.
The accusations against the Kellers by Christy Chaviers and the two other children who testified included being spanked with a belt, being forced to drink urine and feces, seeing animals killed with a chainsaw, having pens and pencils stuck in their orifices, and seeing people put in a hole along with blood and skin to be run over by a car. The emergency room doctor who examined Christy Chaviers found what, at the time, he believed to be evidence of sexual abuse, but he has since changed his mind about his findings. KUT contacted several of the Kellers' victims, now adults in their 20s. None responded to requests for interviews. Karen Hutchins is a licensed counselor and certified hypnotherapist. She owns Cicada Recovery Services in South Austin, where many of the parents involved in the Oak Hill daycare case came for help with their young children.
Things that they talked about, there's no way they could have made up, because we didn't have that kind of TV in those days. When they first started hearing about this stuff in the 70s, they didn't have internet, so there wasn't even that contamination.
A judge heard the Kellers' appeal for a new trial. The request is based on a lack of physical evidence in the case and witnesses recanting their testimony. A path to exoneration may require another hearing, but the Kellers' lawyer hopes to have the couple released and move back to Travis County within the next few months. If he is successful, Fran and Dan Keller may see one another for the first time in 23 years. Karen Bernstein, KUT News.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also post your comments directly on our website at tpr.org. And that's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. Texas Matters is also posted on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.